On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump is probably the most significant thing to happen to the religious right in a few decades.
OMG, this guy is actually a bigot.
If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Food is having its moment on TV. You've got the Belcher family running a hamburger joint in Bob's Burgers, all those discussions about Chinese food in Fresh Off the Boat, and Aziz Ansari is making pasta from scratch in Master of None. This got us thinking. Are these portrayals changing how we view food? Are they moving us to cook more? Well, this month on Good Food, we're going to take a stab at answering those questions. First, we turn to Lola's Eric Eli for some insight. He was the story editor for the HBO series Tremé, in which New Orleans food may have been a main character. Hi, Lola's.
Hey, Evan.
Let's start by hearing a clip from an episode you wrote in the first season of Tremé. In this scene, chef Jeanette Desitel, who's played by actress Kim Dickens, has come up with a menu for a group of really fancy New York chefs who unexpectedly stop by her restaurant. The chefs are David Chang, Eric Rippert, Tom Colicchio, and Wiley Dufresne. Here's Jeanette in the kitchen talking to her sous chef, Jacques.
What you got for me?
Smoked salmon, rounds, and caviar. Seafood truffles, too. Fingerlings, then the lamb off the menu.
We can't out New York bunch of New York chefs. We lowball them. We start with the sweet potato andouille shrimp soup. Then we get the rabbit kidneys out of the freezer. They're tiny. They're going to thaw fast. We skewer them with some lardons of the Benton's bacon. Then we hit them with sweetbreads and crawfish over grits.
You're a devious, devious woman.
Thank. Okay, how about this for the last plate? We still got the braised lamb neck from the staff mule.
You are my chef forever.
So tell us about coming up with that scene. Did Kim know how to cook before taking on the role? And I have to say that I think including Benton, the name, was like genius.
Well, Kim is actually a vegetarian, so it was certainly not a meal she'd otherwise be cooking. But when she was in New Orleans, she'd do some training with Susan Spice over at Biona. And Tom Colicchio let her do some training at Kraft here because she lives mostly in Los Angeles. And in many ways, the idea was that, you know, New York is very much sort of the sun around which the American food world revolves. But the truth is that what we're finally beginning to realize is that the regional cuisines in other places are at least as good and certainly more interesting given what we've already had from New York. And finally, as she says, you can't do better French seafood than Eric Rippert. That ain't going to happen. But I doubt Eric Rippert can do crawfish any better than anybody else in New Orleans. And I should also say, Anthony Bourdain was a big part of the show and of making these kinds of decisions. And so that was the idea, to try to figure out what could this chef do that these other folks wouldn't be able to do. And also to nod to some of the food geeks out there who would recognize Benton's bacon and who also would be interested. For example, lamb neck is becoming increasingly common on menus. Who would be aware of those sorts of things?
And the rabbit kidneys. And I love how just even the word, they're tiny. So for people who maybe have never had a rabbit kidney and might not think about how tiny they would be, there's a lot packed into that dialogue. Was she sort of formed on Susan Spicer?
Yeah, what happens is often you need to base a character on an idea or on a person. But by the time you begin to write them, and certainly by the time you get to, say, the second season, all that has changed. And mind you, Tony Bourdain, especially the rabbit kidneys, that was him, that wasn't me, because he'd read all the things. He'd write many of the food scenes. He'd edit even the ones that he'd necessarily write. As we got further and further into Jeanette Desautel's character, she was less and less based on Susan Spicer. It got to the point in New Orleans where folks kind of wanted us to include them in the show. But the problem is, they might not like what their character did if we included them in the show. We had this an auction, you know, raise money for charity every year. And if you paid a certain amount of money, then your name could appear as a character in the show. Well, this one woman, who actually became a friend of mine lately, bid on this and won it. Her character was a slut in the show. So you got to be careful, not only what you ask for, but also what you pay for.
But that's such a great idea for a silent auction item. Really smart. Here's another clip from an episode you wrote in season two. And in this one, Jeanette's in New York honing her chops in a restaurant owned by David Chang. This really cracks me up, called Lucky Peach. She's just pulled a tray of waffles out of the oven for a staff meal.
Rice flour waffles are a nice touch. Chicken and waffles, I'm guessing. Gooch, come here. Check this out.
I'll be back.
Got chicken and waffles, bitches. Whoa. That's f***ed up. In a really good way. What's the sauce?
It's kind of a reverse vinaigrette. The portions are, like, inverted. It's rice wine vinegar, a little grapeseed oil, and it's just loaded up with bird's eye chilies, garlic, ginger, a little soy. It's good, huh?
Oh, I'm telling you right now, David's going to love this. Dave is going to get a huge stiffy over this. This is right in Dave's happy place.
So when the writers and actors pull it off, what do you think we get from seeing food being eaten, served, and prepared on TV? Are the portrayals changing how we view food?
Well, in many ways, what you're trying to do in any scene is bring people into that scene. And so you can go from the idea of trying to put you in the mind of a murderer, as an example, or in this case, trying to make you feel like you're actually a part, either as a diner or a cook in the restaurant. I think what's really changed in terms of the way food is portrayed is the extent to which the restaurant is not merely a setting, but the kitchen itself is a setting, and actual discussions of food and food preparations become more and more integral to that. You know, what people always say when you're talking about script ideas is they want to see a world they haven't seen before. They will compliment you because, oh, I've never seen that before. Well, until recently, you know, you look at shows like Mel's Diner, which was the setting in Alice, and it's kind of like there is a diner there, and occasionally they might mention food, but they don't even do much with it. Or even a movie like Diner, which is a wonderful movie that doesn't even talk about diner food in any significant sense. It's more about these guys kind of coming of age. Well, now, because so many people are so into food, there are ways that even people who will never attempt to cook these sort of fancy dishes are intrigued by them, want to hear about them. It's really like pornography in the sense that, you know, you're never going to meet these models from Playboy, but you can at least get some sense of a connection and some entree.
What I find must be incredibly challenging in the craft of putting these scripts together is the energy and how it's translated into what ends up on the little box or the big screen. Like these clips that we've played so far, they're real. They sound real. It's so hard to do that with the kitchen. And we all know that from seeing really failed, clunky, awkward scenes that play out in kitchens. And you just want to groan and sort of turn your head away.
Well, a lot of it was the extras in these scenes were for the most part chefs. And what's kind of funny is that in the early part of season two, Jeanette Desautels is making fun of the fact that Alan Richman went to New Orleans and just wrote a trashy article about New Orleans food. The chef who was teasing her in that kitchen is a man named Alan Shaya, whose Shaya restaurant is sort of redefining Middle Eastern cuisine, certainly in New Orleans, and whose other restaurant, Dominica, has brought regional Italian food to New Orleans. So the point is that we got somebody who's a first-rate chef who is a part of that and creating that atmosphere. And also, when David Simon decided to bring Tony Bourdain on as one of the writers, that was his nod to saying, let's get it right. And that goes throughout this particular show as well. The notion that they're trying to come and capture a city's culture. And so Eric Overmyer and David Simon went and found New Orleans who knew about the music, knew about the architecture, knew about the food, so that the show would have that sort of real feeling to it.
David Simon and Eric Overmyer are the creators of Tremé. When I got Tremé, the cookbook, in the mail, I have to say that my eyes rolled back in my head because I'm so used to getting cookbooks that spring forward out of fictional characters that are not very good. But the book that you wrote is fascinating. I mean, it's definitely the best fictional cookbook I've ever read, fictional and real, the way they play back and forth. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. First of all, I'm a food writer from New Orleans who then got into television writing. I'm not certain that I had enough different new to say about New Orleans food for an entire cookbook. But with this sort of fictional architecture on which to place my own ideas and place them in the mouths of these characters, I think that I could create, or I hope to create, a book that'd be compelling. One of the best cookbooks about New Orleans. That was my ambition. And so in that sense, these characters, as I understood them in the context of food, were people I had met and encountered in New Orleans. So while it may not be true that Albert Lambreau's grandmother taught him to make so-and-so, it is absolutely true that somebody has told me about this trick of how to do it. Or as an example, there are two cornbread recipes in the book, one sweet and one not sweet, which is part of the debate that goes on even now. So my point is that if you have these characters who are different, who come from different perspectives and backgrounds, you can have that kind of debate within the pages of the book. The other fictional setup of the book is that Jeanette de Sautel is saying it is not her cookbook, but she, a professional chef and something of an intellectual, is attempting to curate the conversations of our New Orleanian characters. So in that sense, the stories about the history of the food, the stories about the kinds of advice you get from cooks on how to make Creole or Cajun food, all of those things go in there, and all of those things are real.
And as a person who really loved the show and was really sad to see it go away, you get to spend time with these characters in a completely different way, like reading Tony's whole thing.
Oh, Tony Burnett, the lawyer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, we wanted to set a lot of scenes in the show in restaurants, in part because that tells the story of the city. So whereas another show might just have you meet at a coffee shop, we had you meet at a famous restaurant. And so Toni Burnett is not much of a cook, but nonetheless, she's gone to these restaurants. And she is modeled after a friend of mine, Mary Howell, who does a lot of civil rights work in New Orleans. And Mary is kind of like that. Mary doesn't do a whole lot of cooking, but Mary likes good restaurants. And that is a legitimate perspective in terms of how people actually appreciate food and how people have come to appreciate the restaurant culture. The other thing about her situation is that she's married to the John Goodman character, Creighton Burnett, who was more of a gourmand and more vocal in his love of New Orleans. And so the idea of being able to write an essay in his voice about going to the Upper Line restaurant, Joanne Clevenger's restaurant in New Orleans, that meant a lot to me. And that was one of the more autobiographical moments in the book for me.
Yeah, it's fascinating how there are these little essays that just could be published straight on their own, but they come out of this fictional voice talking about a real place.
Well, a lot of that also has to be credited to Nina Noble, one of the executive producers of the show. She was the one who conceived the idea of the cookbook. And I think part of the reason she wanted to do it was because she knew I had a background in food, which is less to blow my own horn as to say that the idea that she had was, if we have someone who we think can do a good job, we'll do it. If not, we won't do it. So, you know, there was not a cookbook on the wire, presumably because there was not someone who's going to be able to write a cookbook that would really do that show justice.
That would be a very different kind of cookbook.
Well, The Sopranos did one, but again, it wasn't quite this. Yeah.
That was, yeah, one of the rolling your eyes. talking about the essays in the book, there are several that, for example, explain how the po' boy was born or the differences between Cajun and Creole cuisine. How did you decide which of these important items and ideas to give time to in the book?
We New Orleanians are lucky in the sense that our emblematic foods are relatively famous. And also, we're a relatively small city or small region, if you include Cajun country. So the important topics are kind of givens. I know if you're going to be in New Orleans 10 days, it's pretty much enough time to taste all the stuff you need to taste, which means the things that you would taste in those 10 days are the things that I want to write about. So in that sense, it was a matter of talking about the emblematic foods and trying to give voice to those questions that you might not have even thought to think about, but they're about topics that I know interest you.
Is there another TV show or movie that we can look forward to on which your expertise has been tapped?
I wish. I keep writing these scripts and trying to sell them, and there's always a food element in the scripts that I'm trying to write. So I got one with this Vietnamese detective who has a half-brother who's a chef in a restaurant. And of course, I think the script is the most brilliant thing ever put on paper. More experienced producers seem to think there may have been one or two other more brilliant ideas that should be on air first. But
hey, I would watch that. I would also read that as a detective novel, just so you know.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Lolis.
Heaven, it's been a pleasure.
Lolis Eric Eli is a writer and filmmaker born in New Orleans who lives in L.A. He wrote Tremé, Stories and Recipes from the Heart of New Orleans, and Smokestack Lightning, Adventures in the Heart of Barbecue Country. It's not so unusual to see food being prepared and eaten on the screen, but what about all the steps we don't often see that go into getting our food to the table? A new film called Lupe Under the Sun fixes the lens on the Mexican migrant workers who pick peaches this time of year in California's Central Valley. Our supervising producer, Abby Fentress-Swanson, spoke with the director of the film, Rodrigo Reyes, ahead of its world premiere at the LA Film Festival next week.
Hi, Rodrigo. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Lupe Under the Sun is fictional, but there seem to be quite a few parallels between the film and your own life. Your family lived in Merced, where the film is set, and the main character, Lupe, is a migrant worker in his 60s whose family is in Mexico. Your grandfather was also a migrant laborer. So give us the backstory.
Well, Lupe Under the Sun is really a film that started because I found out that my grandfather, who had been a migrant worker his whole life, he spent years and decades of his life working in California and going back home to Mexico once a year. I found out that grandpa disappeared one time. You know, he just didn't come back 1 year, and then 2 years went by, and then eventually 5 years later, he showed up back in Mexico, and he never told the family where he was, what he was up to. So I realized, man, I have to tell the story because there's a lot of people that do this still today. You know, here in the Central Valley, there's so many guys who just end up kind of lost. They stay too long and they just lose contact with their family. So I wanted to kind of explore my grandpa's story. I can't talk to him anymore because he passed away. And I also want to pay celebration to the men who have done all this work and who have kind of come into this dead end in their lives.
The film, the way it's shot, is classic neorealist style. And so we get to sort of see Lupe getting up each day at 4 a.m. before he makes breakfast, fried eggs that he stuffs into a tortilla. Then we're with him picking peaches in the field, sipping a tall can of beer, visiting his girlfriend Gloria on the bike he so lovingly takes care of. I love that little detail. And the film is really a day in the life of Lupe, and it gives us a sense of what a migrant worker's life looks like. Can you talk about why you decided to shoot the film in this very specific style?
You know, I felt like immigrants are a population that we're always talking about in the news, and they're always part of the, you know, the election cycle and all this stuff, but we never really get to see what they do. They're like the fundamental link in our food chain. They're the very first hands on our food. They bring it from the fields to our table, and we never really see their lives in a way that is honest and sincere. You know, here you have this guy who doesn't really talk much for most of the movie, but by the end of the movie, you feel like you know him because you're hanging out with him and you're hanging out in this world that is like kind of on the margins of society that nobody really pays attention to, and he doesn't even pay attention to himself, you know. So I wanted to celebrate his world and to really embrace it, put audiences in it so that they could feel like they were there in the peach orchard and they were there like cycling through the streets and, you know, going to the store and living the life of this man.
Yeah. And you actually cast real farm workers, I understand, Danielle and Ana Moratala, to play Lupe and Gloria.
Yes, they're actual farm workers. They're family friends. My family still works in agriculture. So I met them through those connections. And I felt really strongly about having non-professional actors, people who are part of this community, and to put them in this place where they get to tell a story about people that they know. Danny and Ana are actually married in real life. And in the movie, they play like a boyfriend-girlfriend kind of relationship, which was really interesting. And it was also great to see them kind of make that connection between what they know and what they've experienced and this story. They all know people like Lupe who have kind of become ghosts. It ended up being a really powerful experience. And when you watch the film, you don't really get the sense that they're untrained actors. I mean, they do a phenomenal job portraying the emotions of this man and the emotions of this woman who loves him and wants him to commit, but is also in pain because he doesn't want to commit to her either. So I was just really lucky that they trusted me to work with them.
Towards the end of the film, things are not going so well for Lupe. He stops going to work. He lies to the doctor about all the beer he's drinking. He severs ties with his girlfriend, Gloria. He's depressed, low on funds, and seems to be more and more isolated from everyone around him. So when I was watching this, I was starting to think, oh no, you know, we are not going down a good road here. And after I saw the film, I won't give it all away for people who haven't seen it, but I was reading your director's statement, and you wrote that you were angry with Lupe. Can you talk about why?
I realized as I was finishing the movie that I felt that Lupe had betrayed his family because he hadn't gone back, that he had stayed here too long and just kind of abandoned them. And I guess I transferred that grudge onto my grandfather, and I couldn't understand why a man would do that. And then as I got closer and closer to actually finishing, I realized that he was also learning about himself. That, you know, Lupe was caught in a situation, and folks who are working outdoors in the heat and crossing borders and committing all these sacrifices to come and try to make a living, like, a lot of times they just get caught up in the cycle. And so the movie kind of let me reconcile with that and understand that, you know, mistakes are made. It was a very interesting thing for me to discover that I had such strong emotions about it, because I felt very detached at the beginning, and then I realized that it was something that really affected me.
I'd like to round out or finish our discussion by reading a quote from you. This is another one that you wrote in your director's statement. You say, "Every city and town in California has ghosts. Every immigrant community has a Lupe, a man who just disappeared across the border and became a lost soul. Their stories fall silently by the wayside, ignored and overlooked, perhaps because we are afraid of what they have to say about the great American dream." Talk to me about writing those couple of lines and how they relate to the film.
You know, I think we're living in a time in America right now where we there's a lot of people whose stories are going ignored, and people are angry about that, people are upset, and we need to start listening to those stories. Because they tell us about who we are. You know, we don't just get to tell the stories that are shining successes. You know, we also need to understand the pain that people have gone through. And in a lot of ways, Lupe is very similar to a blue-collar worker in Pennsylvania or in the Midwest, all over the country. You know, he's just a hardworking man who thought that that's all he had to do, just work hard. And now he finds out that life is about something bigger than that, and he has to make, you know, big decisions. And when you watch the film, you don't really know if Lupe has papers or not. And there's a purpose to that. It's because his story is really a human story. It isn't an immigration story as much as it is a story about growing old and realizing that we need to kind of, you know, acknowledge that that's going on out there, that there are people out there for whom the dream isn't working.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us and for making this wonderful film.
Thank you, Abby.
That was our supervising producer, Abby Fentress-Swanson, talking to Rodrigo Reyes. Find out where to get tickets for Lupe Under the Sun on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Tune into the show next week for more stories in our Food on the Screen series. Next, it's all about the pink fish. Stay.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. Put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Salmon is one of the most popular fish in North America, and it's back in season right now. But as with any fish in demand, there are concerns about sustainability and supply. In Portland, Oregon, Diane Morgan takes on the subject in her new book, Salmon: Everything You Need to Know and 45 Recipes. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Evan.
You first published a cookbook on salmon 10 years ago. I'm curious to know what's changed in the last decade that made you decide to revisit it.
It's two parts. We've so gone around the world with global flavors that I really wanted to expand the recipes in terms of what flavor pairings are possible with salmon. And in addition, there's new techniques that I really wanted to explore, one of them being a low-tech sous vide style of salmon that I've done, which is really fun for the home cook. No equipment needed. The second part of it is really that 10 years ago, if someone said to me, okay, yes to farm salmon, no to farm salmon, my answer would have been no. And I only eat wild-caught salmon. And now it's not that black and white because there's been so many technology changes in the world of farming salmon that there are better techniques and better technologies that are allowing us to bring more farm-raised salmon into the market that does meet environmental issues, sustainability issues, and that's been shown through the Monterey Bay Seafood Watch program. They are approving certain farm salmon now.
For many people, that's going to be surprising to hear. I mean, here in America, I mean, we have this incredible resource, the Alaskan salmon fishery, which is only wild fish. Could you speak a little bit about that?
Alaskan salmon will always be at the top of my chart, first choice for the salmon I'm eating. That said, off the coast of California, Washington, Oregon, salmon is available and is commercially fished. Depending on the season, you know, right now, California in the drought, the commercial fishing is way more limited. Oregon and Washington are both having issues, though Oregon this summer will be stronger. But Alaska manages their stocks, and they do a really good job of it. They have way more conservation efforts so that the streams are healthy where the salmon can go up and spawn.
What are the key biological differences between Atlantic and Pacific salmon?
Atlantic salmon, there's only one species. Pacific salmon, there's seven. That's a big difference because you have different varieties of Pacific salmon. And it's seasonal. The salmon season has started. And so what's coming onto the market is the beautiful sockeyes and some of the kings. Then we move into the coho salmon coming into the market and later the pinks and the chums. So it's really following that season, getting it fresh, getting it at the best price.
And with farmed salmon, which is the variety that tends to be the most prevalent in farm salmon stocks?
Mostly it's Atlantic. They are doing some Pacific salmon. I know they're farm raising some kings, but most of what you see, especially in Europe on the eastern seaboard, is you're seeing Atlantic salmon.
As a chef, having seen a lot of fish, my experience of a lot of farm salmon in the past was a fish that was flabby, super fatty, like almost looking akin to the marbling in beef, and an overly mild flavor. Has that changed?
Not really. Just recently, I was doing a live demo, and I bought a piece of farm salmon and had it side by side with an Oregon Troll king salmon fillet. In a blind test, having cooked it exactly the same, I cedar planked it on the grill. In a blind test, the average person would be really hard-pressed to tell the difference in terms of taste. you'd really have to be paying close attention. But you nailed it in terms of texture. You know, if you think about it, farm salmon, they don't have to work. They're really just swimming around in these pens, whether it's an open net pen or a closed system. And so they don't have the journeys of a wild-caught salmon.
Could you talk a bit about labeling the terms organic, certified organic, and all natural farm-raised and wild-caught?
Oh, yeah. Wild-caught is the term now being used for wild salmon that are commercially fished. The reason it's wild-caught is because in Oregon, Washington, California, about 50% of all wild-caught salmon is hatchery-raised. In Alaska, it's only about 30%. So it was deemed not like absolutely true to call it just wild. With regard to farm salmon, the only salmon that you would see labeled as organic would be coming out of Europe because they have organic certification for their salmon, and the USDA has never established that for seafood. So if it is farm salmon off the coast of Washington, it might be labeled as all natural. It can't be labeled organic. And so anything else is, you know, sustainably raised or natural is all marketing language.
And organic, when it comes to a fish, does it refer to the feed rather than the fish itself?
Yeah, absolutely.
You mentioned earlier the drought. And I'm wondering if the issue of this threat that's posed by marijuana growers to the Chinook salmon fisheries is actually a part of the drought conversation.
Well, it's funny. It's like everyone wants to be so, you know, eco-friendly and, you know, cool, we're raising marijuana plants. But in fact, marijuana plants are tropical. They take a lot of water. They also take pesticides. And so what they are doing is conflicting with some of these natural salmon rivers and tributaries because the water is being taken out of it to help grow the marijuana plants. And there's what's called nonspecific runoff, which are these pesticides that are used in the fields to grow the marijuana plants that are leaching their way back into the waterways, and it's killing off salmon.
And this, of course, is happening in California.
Yeah. Yeah, and Southern Oregon.
And are we talking about, like, certified legal marijuana farms, or are we talking about sort of renegade growing?
Well, no. I mean, it's both. But now we're getting into the certified ones because it's legal in Oregon. I mean, these plantings are established, they're legally grown, and it's not an ideal situation for salmon rivers.
Let's start to talk about something more delicious, actually making and eating salmon. Why don't we start with that outlaw sous vide that you mentioned earlier?
I love you calling it outlaw sous vide. Salmon only needs to cook to really between 100 and 125 degrees max. And if you have an oven on low and you put the salmon in freezer strength, lock top plastic bags, and you get all the air out, you get your water to 125. And the salmon has been put in the bags and is not stone cold. It's been out of the refrigerator for about a half hour. Why can't you just put that in the oven and maintain the 125 degrees of the water and let the salmon, quote unquote, cook sous vide style in the low oven? And it works. So I just use my turkey roasting pan and I can get, you know, 8 or 10 servings of salmon, if I want that many, individually packaged in the Ziploc bags. And it completely works. In 20 to 25 minutes, you have beautifully cooked sous vide salmon without the equipment.
At what temperature do you need to have the oven to maintain that 125 degree water?
Just low temperature, like the lowest your oven will go. You know, mine is about 140, 130. You can set it at that temperature and even just preheat it to that and then turn it off. And as long as your water is at 125 and you set the roasting pan in the oven, you're good to go.
And now I'd like to ask you about the global flavors you were talking about before. When I think about salmon, I think about such a distinctive flavored fish that is so embedded in my mind with things like dill and cucumber, very sort of Northern European flavors, maybe pesto, maybe salsa verde. But what are some of the combinations that you've come up with that are a bit more assertive, that were actually surprising to you?
One that I tried just on a fluke is I was doing a tofu and vegetable green curry with coconut milk. And I just thought, why would I not try this with salmon? And I did it with salmon and snow peas and some green onions. And I love it. It picks up this bright flavor. The coconut milk marries perfectly with the salmon. It's beautiful. You have the coral color of the fish against the creamy green curry braising liquid, and the brightness of the sugar snap peas popped in there, or snow peas, whichever you find. Just put that over a little mound of jasmine rice and it's great. In addition, I made a little sauce to go with a pan braised dish I did with salmon, and it's a sriracha sauce. And it's also, it just takes on this really bright, full flavor against the richness of the fish, and it completely works.
One of my favorite parts of your recipes is the fact that you acknowledge leftovers. What's your favorite way to get creative with remnants from last night's salmon dinner?
I love making salmon salad rolls using the rice paper and then just mixing it up with whatever you want to toss inside besides the rice vermicelli noodles. It's a great way to use up salmon, especially grilled salmon, because it has that nice smoky flavor with it. I toss it into risotto. I toss it into pasta. I make potato hash, a frittata. I have a recipe for a Korean bibimbap with salmon, but that's a great place to use leftover salmon and make a rice bowl.
Thank you so much, Diane.
Oh, well, it's a delight. Thank you.
That was Diane Morgan. Her new book is Salmon, Everything You Need to Know and 45 Recipes. Find a recipe for green curry braised salmon on the Good Food blog. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Now it's time to find out what's in season in our neck of the woods. Take it away, Laura.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. It is early June. We are celebrating the market. We're celebrating the changing of the seasons. And one thing we celebrate is the appearance of the really tasty apricots that you can only get here at the farmer's market. And I'm so happy to be visiting right now with Valerie Gordon. She's at Grand Central Market. She's in Echo Park. She sells at the Hollywood Farmer's Market. Apparently, Valerie, your overall company is going to be rebranded Valerie Confections Bakery and Cafe. What are you getting today at the market?
I am getting some delicious golden sweet apricots from Frog Hollow Farm. They are perfect apricots.
And when we talk about perfect apricots, we're talking about the small, speckled, sort of ugly, sort of soft, that apricot.
Yes, and not at all mushy, with right. Sort of tight flesh and just a really incredible depth of flavor that sort of balances sweet and tart with just an amazing sort of undercurrent of sugar. It's just so incredible.
And you are so inspired by these. What are you going to make with them?
The question, Laura, is what am I not making with these apricots? What's so great about them is they're only here for a few weeks, right? And so just really celebrating them and making the most of them is the goal. We are putting them in both sweet and savory applications. I love to pair apricots with almonds, and I also love to pair an apricot with basil. For instance, we're doing a basil panna cotta this week with a golden sweet compote and candied pistachios on top. So that's a wonderful marriage of flavors. And then in a very savory way, we're doing a apricot salad tossed in olive oil with fleur de sel and freshly chiffonade basil. The apricots are also going into an almond cake with some of the Rainier cherries from David Karp at Andy's Orchards that he brought down this week. And I'm certain they will find their way into a couple of pies as well.
And maybe a few jams.
And maybe a few jams. Doing the golden sweet as a jam with some black tea in it is a delicious marriage.
You know, a lot of the stone fruit, the peaches, they have kind of a bitter skin or a tough skin or something. But the apricot, it doesn't seem to have that.
Because you don't have to peel anything. You don't have to blanch anything. All you can do is just, I mean, bite into one, which is incredible, of course. But just slice and bake, slice and cook, and it's great. It's so easy, and it tastes like summer.
And Frog Hollow only comes once a week to Wednesday, so you've got to be right here ready to go or pre-order to get what you need.
They're sort of like this special guest star at the market, right? It's almost like when they show up, there's this swell of excitement around their booth, and it happens in the summer, and then it happens again in the fall when they show up with their worn pears, which are just, it's like bespoke fruit. It is the most exceptional, beautiful, fully flavored fruit, and they have adorable boxes also, which had like this amazing little farm scene on them. We're like staring at them right now. Right. It's so great.
Right. And Frog Hollow does come in twice a year. They're going to come in during cherry and apricot season, then they go away for the summer, then they'll come back. So Valerie, always looking forward, always loving what you're tasting and finding all of your offerings extremely acceptable.
Thank you, Laura. I strive for your acceptance.
That was Valerie Gordon. She is rebranding her wonderful bakeries and her fabulous chocolate store as Valerie Confections Bakery and Cafe. Look for them at Grand Central Market, in Echo Park, at the Hollywood Farmers Market, and at her flagship, Valerie Confections. I'm talking now with Freddie Tapia. He works with Frog Hollow Farm. And we want to find out, Freddie, from you, why is it that your Golden Sweet apricots taste so good? What do you do to make them so fabulous?
Well, we just take very good care of them. First of all, we pick them when they're like at their peak. We don't pick them when they're green. So when it gets to the market, the customer gets the best of the best.
How do you know when they're ready? And do you go back several times to the same tree to pick over and over again?
Yes. As soon as it gets a little blush in them, that's when we know that the apricot's almost in its peak, picking only the best.
What's the best way to pick an apricot?
Best way to give it a little twist, because if you pull it straight from the tree, it's going to peel the stem, and it's going to go bad pretty fast.
It seems like most of the apricots grown in the country come from California. Do you know maybe why California's weather is so perfect for apricots?
Apricots need a lot of hot days. And the weather in Valley in California, it's just perfect for them. Really, really hot and pretty cool nights.
And you grew up in Brentwood, California, not the one down here that's like right by Santa Monica, but way up in near, closer to San Francisco, to the Bay Area. What's the weather like?
We have pretty hot days and pretty cool nights. The breeze from the bay just pushes its way into the delta, and it helps a lot on the flavor of the fruit.
Okay, well, I don't think anybody else sells the Golden Sweets here except you.
Yeah, and even in Northern California, we're only like one out of three farmers that have Golden Sweets.
Okay, well, we'll keep it a secret.
Keep it a secret.
Okay. All right, well, thank you so much, Freddie.
No, thank you, guys.
That was Freddie Tapia. He works with Frog Hollow Farm. He knows all about how they grow their trees, the certified organic orchard for over 30 years, and he's very proud of the fruit he brings into the market here. I want to invite everybody to join me this Sunday at our Main Street Farmers Market, located on Main Street at Ocean Park Boulevard. We will be part of a citywide Open Streets Festival where we will be closing off Main Street for the whole day on Sunday, and the Main Street Farmers Market will be featuring cooking demo by local chef Kim Vu of Vucatious Catering. She will be showing how to cook produce direct from the farmers market. See you there. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
In a minute, we consider a breaded and deep-fried Japanese pork cutlet. That's when the show continues. Stay close.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
I know we've been talking a lot about pork chops on the show lately, but this is a pork chop. tonkatsu.
That's LA Times food critic Jonathan Gold.
It's a fillet of pork or cutlet of pork dipped in flour, egg, and panko, the breadcrumbs, and fried until it's just this beautiful, glistening, textured, velvety brown.
And where are we having this?
We're going to a place called Kagura in Torrance, in sort of the old part of town.
Is the history of tonkatsu in Japan, is it related at all to schnitzel?
Yeah. The Portuguese parked their boats outside Nagasaki for a while, and that's where tempura came in. From what I've read, tonkatsu is more recent than that. There was this fad for Viennese things, and it was like a late 19th century imitation of Wiener schnitzel.
What is the menu like? Is it just tonkatsu? Do they have different kinds of pork that they offer you?
It's a long menu, and I think if you didn't know it was a tonkatsu specialist, you might even be able to ignore the fact that it was a tonkatsu restaurant at all. There's platters of sliced tamachi with wasabi relish, or grilled mushroom salads, or steamed clams, or different kinds of pasta. There's a pasta with an uni cream sauce.
Wow.
But there's a couple of pages in the menu that do, in fact, have tonkatsu and variations on tonkatsu. And I think at least the first time you go there, that's where you should concentrate.
What should we order?
There are basically four different kinds of tonkatsu. One is loin, which might be the one I would go for. There's filet, which is a little bit more expensive, but has not as much fat in it and tends to be a little bit drier. There is something they called mi-fui, which is actually incredibly good there. It's thin pork that's been rolled up into the slice of a pork chop and then battered and fried.
So it's sort of like when you're a little kid and you take slices of bologna and you roll them up and you put them in your mouth. That's kind of like what it's like before they bread it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a more complicated structure than that, but probably not that much more complicated.
What is it served with?
It comes on a big tray. It itself comes on this sort of beautiful draining rack so that it stays crisp all the way around. There is a pitcher of sauce. You can put it together one of several ways. They give you a grooved Japanese mortar with toasted sesame seeds in it, and you take a little pestle and you crush them and the aroma comes up, and then you can dribble sauce in that. There's another little bowl with a dab of super hot, like Chinese mustard. You can either put sauce in that or just dab it onto the meat directly.
When I was in Japan, it was served with a copious amount of very thinly sliced white cabbage. Do they do that here?
Yes, it is so good. It's just a simple aromatic dressing with soy and vinegar and a couple of other things. It doesn't seem like there's any oil in it at all. And you eat that to, you know, cut the richness of the pork. They will keep refilling that as you eat. There's thin slices of pickled daikon that actually look like the kind that you buy from the supermarket. They would not be the first thing you would go to on a Japanese pickle tray, but they seem to go very well with the meat. And then, I don't know, macaroni salad or something.
Yeah, something slathered in mayonnaise.
Right.
Or kewpie.
Because you have to have the mayonnaise course.
Yeah. Did you ever go on your return visits and have a meal of the non-tonkatsu items?
Well, I was never able to go there and not get tonkatsu, but I ate a bunch of the other stuff. There are these potato balls that are sort of the size and the shape and the heft of hockey pucks that are stuffed with molten cheese, and those are kind of great. There is that spaghetti and the thick sea urchin cream sauce, which is not usually a good bet. Most places that serve it, but it's good there. And there's something I love called kamameshi, which is rice that is slow cooked for 40 minutes with mushrooms. And you order that at the beginning of the meal, and it takes 40 or 50 minutes to cook, and then they take the lid off. The aroma of the mushrooms and the rice is just beautiful. I also liked something they called mochi agadashi. I mean, you've had tofu agadashi, which is fried tofu in sort of a slippery sauce. And this has the tofu, and it also has fried mochi, the sticky rice cake, which is so gooey that when you pick it up with your chopstick, the trail of...
Of gooey rice.
Gooey rice. You know, it's like certain pizzas we have all known.
Yeah, instead of the cheese pull, it's the sticky rice pull.
When you're there, you'll have the option of ordering the tonkatsu, or they do a really nice sort of seared cod dish that would be the best pescatarian thing to get. Either plain, or you can get it as gozen, which comes with, you know, the miso soup. It comes with sort of an earthy... 5-grain, but mostly rice concoction, like brown rice. That's shredded cabbage. And I think you're going to want all of that.
Wow, that sounds so good. Did you have room for dessert?
You're not going to have room for dessert. But if for some reason you do or you're curious, they do something called a banana cutlet, which is essentially like banana tonkatsu. That's battered and fried and served with chocolate sauce and a scoop of ice cream. There's something that's very feral zoo about it, but it's kind of delicious anyway.
I would go for that. That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about tonkatsu at Kagura in Torrance. Text the words good food to 69866 to get more weekly restaurant recommendations from Jonathan. Next, we turn our focus to some of the first cooks to feed our nation's founding fathers. That's when the show continues. Stay with us.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
Some kitchen stories are complicated, full of mystery and missing pieces, the truth hidden by time. No photographs to capture them, and little historical record to go on. Black Chef's White House from the Kitchen Sisters takes us to the president's kitchen and to some of the first cooks to feed the founding fathers, the enslaved chefs of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson.
Well, now we're on tape, so can you describe your initial employment here the first day or how you met
LBJ?
The first night that I met President Johnson, it was late as usual. He was always late for meals. Now, there have been times that he'd get on the phone himself and call me and ask me how long would it take me to get something ready for the whole cabinet. And sometimes he'd walk in with them and you didn't even know he was coming. And I've seen time that I fixed a meal in 10 minutes for 25 or 30 people.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't even consider the history of the White House without realizing that the common denominator of White House life is the dinner table. My name is William Seal. I've written several books on the history of the White House. George Washington took office. He wasn't a king. He was a combination of head of state and prime minister. It never happened before. It was very delicate with him how to proceed from the diplomatic tradition, so food became very important. He had a slave chef named Hercules.
It was Hercules who really began this long connection between presidents and African-American cooks. My name is Sharon Conrad, historian in African-American cuisine. Hercules traveled with Washington to Philadelphia. Philadelphia was the U.S. capital prior to Washington, D.C.
Even with those hand-carved teeth, George Washington enjoyed good cuisine. My name is Joe Randall. I founded the African American Chefs Hall of Fame. Wherever George Washington was, at the Capitol or in his home, he wanted Hercules cooking.
Hercules was commander of the kitchen. He did everything, all the souffles. He had about 8 assistants. He was very grand in Philadelphia, going down the street and people following him, watching him as he went to the market.
I am William Moyes Weaver, food historian and author. Philadelphia was the largest open-air market in the world during its day and age. The boats came in from Cuba 3 days a week. There were bananas and pineapples, people exchanging furniture for beef. And if you had the money, you could get practically anything you wanted.
Hercules was noted for being a dandy. He walked through the streets of Philadelphia dressed impeccably in a velvet waistcoat with a gold-headed cane. I'm Jessica Harris, historian of African Americans and food. There is even a portrait that is alleged to have been made of him. He is this large cinnamon-colored man in immaculate chef's white and a toque. When Washington was getting ready to leave Philadelphia to return to Mount Vernon, Hercules goes missing. Hercules escapes. Washington searched for him assiduously, offered rewards, and he was never found. A French visitor to Mount Vernon asked one of Hercules' daughters how she felt about her father running away. She replied, "I miss my father, but I know that he is free, and so I am happy for him." Many of us have heard of Sally Hemings and her alleged relationship with Jefferson, which is increasingly becoming not alleged, but a matter of DNA fact. But most of us don't know about her brother. James Hemings was also a slave to Thomas Jefferson.
When he was appointed minister to France in 1784, Jefferson decided that he was going to take 19-year-old James Hemings with him to Paris to apprentice in the art of cookery.
He went from the hearth cooking that was the good, solid country cooking of Monticello to cooking on a potager, a stew hole stove. He learned the art of saucing things.
James Hemings' recipe for snow eggs. Take 10 eggs, separate the yolks from the whites, and beat the whites as you do for the savory cake, till you can turn the vessel bottom upward.
It was a time of great upheaval in Paris. As the society was democratizing itself, so was the food. We see the development of restaurants, restaurer, to restore. Food coming out of the chateau, coming out of the royal kitchens, becoming more democratic. At the same time, the royal family is falling. James Hemings was there to see and witness these changes.
There was no slavery in Paris at that time. James could have taken advantage of that by claiming his freedom, but that did not happen.
Hemings returns to Monticello with Jefferson, and he petitions for his freedom. Jefferson insists that Hemings must wait long enough to train another.
After 3 years of teaching his brother, Peter Hemings, the art of French cookery, James was freed.
We're not really sure what happens to him after that. He was asked to return to cook when Jefferson was in the White House, but beyond that, we don't know.
Shrimp curry a la Zephyr Wright. 2 pounds raw shrimp, shelled and deveined. 5 tablespoons.
Do you remember anything in particular about the last days?
Those last days in the White House, Mr. Johnson said, "Are you going with us to Texas?" And I said, "No, that I would be staying here." And he said that it won't be the same without you. And whenever he came to Washington, he'd always call me.
Ready?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That was Black Chef's White House, a story produced by the Kitchen Sisters. Find a link to more stories in their Hidden Kitchen series on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com, via iTunes, or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find Good Food on demand on KCRW's mobile app. As always, so many thanks to the Good Food team. That's Abby Fentress-Swanson, Laurel Garcia, Camelia Tse, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, Jillian Ferguson, Ronnie Mickelson, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.